So what are we digging into today?
Today I wanted to talk about Project Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Biggest movie in the US right now.
Obviously the big name attached to this film is Ryan Gosling. I was really interested to see how that would turn out. Good pacing, it kept me engaged. And this is me knowing how it ends before it even starts rolling. Right? And I was still like, what's next? Except I know what's next because I read the book. Welcome to StoryJoy. Today I'm joined by Edward. And what are we digging into today?
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Absolutely. This is the first time we get to do it together. I think we've talked, you've come to a number of, like, we'll call it small time screenings I've done.
Yeah.
So I knew you were probably keen for something like this, but I know not everyone wants to get in front of the camera. So I appreciate you finally coming together on this one. I was glad I could bring you out.
Yeah, wanted to do this for a while. Just finally kind of forced myself to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only way to do it sometimes. All right, so what are we digging into today?
Today I wanted to talk about Project Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Biggest movie in the US right now.
This is a bit unique because it's not a sequel. It's not part of, like, you know, it's not Marvel, it's not DC, it's not Star Wars, it's not any of that. It's kind of its own thing. And the author hasn't written that many novels, and one was already adapted some years ago, The Martian. So you looked at the numbers. So why? How well did it do, and why does that matter?
Yeah, so really impressive numbers. The current domestic box office is $200 million.
That's solid.
Yeah,
I'd take that.
Yeah. Typically, you want to double your marketing for global numbers, and that's like the benchmark of profitability. So this is definitely on its way, and it's looking to do really well. And I think particularly of note, as Michael mentioned, you know, this is an original property. Like, there's not like a lot of things attached to it. This is the first time this has, you know, had an adaptation. And, you know, people say they want original properties, but they don't always do that well.
Right. And they don't always get funding. I was really impressed by how much budget it seemed to get. And I think you mentioned the number earlier when we were chatting. It's about $190 million across the whole production, I think marketing as well, which is, I mean, that's like Marvel levels of investment, which is very impressive. Obviously, they've got, you know, Ryan Gosling and some other folks as well. But it was nice. You have this sort of, you know, quote-unquote original property. I guess there was a bit of proof already in The Martian. I think that did well. I did not look at the numbers before, but it's well regarded. It also had some, you know, biggish names in there. And so they may have viewed this as a sort of a safer bet than if this author hadn't sort of already done this before.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, I think the directors too have been pretty tested, right?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the big name attached to this film is Ryan Gosling, which, again, as a sci-fi fan, where I'm accustomed to a lot of great stories not getting a lot of budget or having very strange casting decisions, I was really interested to see how that would turn out. Now, what did you think of him? I guess, one, in this role, but two, we were talking about this earlier, the sort of roles he tends to take.
I thought he was very likable in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I was thinking about these other films of his, like Blade Runner, Barbie also, he tends to play this outsider character.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily very likable, and it's intended to be not very likable. But in some ways, I think, like, based on his other movies, he's almost typecast into this unlikable outsider character. However, in this movie, he plays an outsider, but I thought he was incredibly likable.
Oh, yeah.
You're
rooting for Grace.
Yeah,
in this one for sure. Like, in basically, he is a science teacher who had dreams of kind of being a quote unquote serious scientist because of certain stances he took, and also how he interacted with some people and made the wrong people angry. He didn't end up doing that.
I think they really grounded their character by having him as a teacher in the beginning, because, you know, for the most of the film, he's just super sciencing his way out of all the problems.
That is true. And there's a bit of an arc in that way, right? because of his choices and his perspectives previously, he didn't get to sort of achieve his professional dream. And this, obviously, even though it's a very scary thing, is his opportunity to kind of redeem himself, right? And to achieve in a different way one of his dreams of pursuing what kind of the cutting edge of, you know, scientific exploration, discovery.
I think there's the typical hero's journey that his character takes, where he kind of is able to overcome this thing that, you know, caused them to kind of be on the outside of his field. And then actually really quickly, he becomes kind of the foremost expert in this, in the world.
Yeah. That's why he sort of gets sucked into the whole project and they won't let him go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So we talked about the character Grace and his hero's journey, but he did not volunteer to be a hero. In fact, at multiple points, he wanted to back out. He's like, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a part of this. I don't want to have to put my neck out there. He enjoyed doing the science-y bit, but when it came to, we'll call it, like, real responsibility and the stress around that, I think he tended to get cold feet. You know, his cortisol level spiked, and he's like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, that was really funny and surprising bit of the film.
Yeah.
Because, like, for me, I don't know if it's different because you read the book, right? I just assumed, oh, he like volunteered himself and he just like forgot, you know?
Yeah, he's like, oh, did I sign that paperwork? No. But I mean, and I think the fact that he did not want to, and even after being, you know, basically shown, hey, if you don't do, like, all of humanity is relying on this, you're the only one to be, you know, to come up to speed, and any delay can mean millions of more deaths and all that, and famine and all that sort of stuff. And he was still like, no, I don't want to do that. It's very humanizing because I think almost we all love the story where someone's like, yes, I will totally sacrifice myself for this. And people do that, right? But most people won't want to, or just understandably, he felt like, well, why do I have, surely there's better people for this, right? I'm a science teacher who kind of got lucky and being brought into this project to be helpful, but like, I am not built for this sort of thing. I don't have any interest. I don't have the training.
Yeah.
Right. For space and such. And so it makes it feel real to me. Like, no, this is like how I think most people on some level, he's within the normal spectrum, would react to being asked to do this if this was not something they had kind of planned for. Like the same way, you know, when you sign up to be an astronaut, you kind of understand what you're signing up for, right? To a great degree.
Right.
And so you accept those risks. He had not done that.
Right. He's just a teacher scientist.
Exactly. Something gone wrong. The people that were supposed to go because of an explosion didn't end up. And so they're like, well, who else do we have who has, you know, the requisite knowledge? We have to bring up, and he was one of them for, I think, the scientists, because they needed, what was it, like a physicist or an engineer and something else. They had like three people.
Yeah, like a pilot too, right? So like one kind of like sporty guy, the pilot.
Yeah, exactly. And then some other sort of engineer scientist type to handle stuff. I think he was supposed to be the biologist, and that was his main role. So it's interesting that he made it work at all. But we do see it come up where he's like, I don't know how any of this stuff works. I do think, though, that his decision, to the extent he had a choice, at least at the start, to not do it, feels like a really real response. But then ultimately he's told, well, we understand, but we really don't have a choice, and therefore neither do you. And unfortunately, this isn't about you, and this is not, you know, we're not trying to be mean, but we just can't afford to not have you do this, right? The survival of humanity quite literally could be, you know, depend on this.
Yeah.
And so choosing will kind of like the greater good, if you will, at the expense of the individual. And this is, I think, a common thing that we think about where it's like, well, you know, for the individual, it's all loss and no win. But for the group, right, in this case, it's all of humanity, it's huge. And we'd say, well, obviously, you sacrifice the one person for you know, the $8 billion. Easy choice in terms of like math, but then a human level, and you think about like once you know the person, you're like, oh, this is not so easy, because for him, he is the whole world in a way.
Right. It's his life that he's deciding on.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean,
or someone else has decided. Right.
Yeah, ultimately, someone else decided for him because they're like, okay, well, we were hoping you'd make the right decision. Since you didn't, we're going to make it for you. Good luck. I think it's wild they ended up having to like basically run him down and knock him out and just like essentially just put him on the rocket. He wakes up at some point. Watching the movie, it seems to imply like there's almost a romantic undertone. Though I was watching a video between Ryan Gosling and the female actor who plays that role, and they're like, no, this is actually not that. In fact, this was the purpose of it, is that you can sort of have this respect and like if you have platonic love or care or closeness, where it doesn't have to be this trope where, oh, they must have some sort of romantic engagement, because that happens a lot, right? In any sort of story, like, oh, we need some sort of love interest or thing to happen. And here it just didn't happen. She did care about him. And I think that made her decision all the more like difficult and also powerful. She's like, I care about you a lot, but I also know that this is the decision that needs to be made. And therefore it's like, you know, emotionally difficult, but she still makes it.
That's a good analysis of that. Because like I feel like after hearing you talk about it, I think about, oh, this part really grounded the character, because like it explained like his background and gave him a lot more detail as like a more three-dimensional person than just, you know, because otherwise, I guess going back to what I was thinking about earlier, it's like it does feel like he's a super scientist and just using science as like a superpower to kind of solve every single problem.
And he does. And this brings into another thing I know we want to talk about, or at least I did, which is that Andy Weir, so the author of this book as well as The Martian, has a hard formula. It's a good formula, but it's definitely, for you know, because The Martian, as I was telling you, it's like, okay, a crew is on Mars, a storm happens, they're all trying to leave. The main character, the other crew thinks that he's lost in the storm and probably died, so they take off. Turns out he didn't die. And then he has to figure out how to survive long enough for Earth, people on Earth, to figure out how to get there and get him out of there, right? So a lot of him trying to be clever, and he happened to be a scientist, of course. and so he did figure out a bunch of stuff on his own. But there is an element, and the same way I feel about anything written by Andy Sorkin. The dialogue is a little too clever in his work, right? It's excellent dialogue, but everyone's so darn clever. You're like, yeah, this is not entirely, I'm enjoying it, right? But I also know it's just like, yeah, the likelihood of it just everyone being this sharp all the time, very low. Great writing, love the dialogue, excellent television.
Yeah.
And in a different way, but the similar idea with these characters that Andy Weir writes, like they are just a little too clever, where they always just kind of figure it out. And they're only one person. Now, granted, in The Martian, I think the character gets some help from Earth, because they do have some communication where there's like none of that happening. In Project Hail Mary, once he launches, it. He's truly right. In isolation until he meets a character we'll talk about in just a moment. So there is a formula. I think it works. I do like it, but it is very clear. And sometimes the main character just feels a little too clever. but it works for the story, but you're like, unlikely. Even smart people need a lot more time than these folks have to figure out difficult problems on the fly, particularly in areas that they may not be at all expert in. Right, because Grace is a biologist. I forget what the main character in The Martian originally is. He might also be. But they both have to fix problems that, although technically involving science, are well outside of their fields.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and would require a depth of knowledge and potentially experience to figure out that quickly.
It's good that you mentioned that. I think it really reminds me a lot of like the details that I'm forgetting from The Martian.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's like in that way, they're both almost superheroes.
Yeah. And I guess that's one of the, this is the cool thing about what Andy Weir does in his writing. Mm-hmm. Like, they're superheroes, but they're also normal people.
Right.
I think Grace is more, is closer to a normal person or someone mm-hmm. you feel like you just run into mm-hmm. than the main character in The Martian, who's, I think it's Waltney, maybe is his name. I know the internet will remind me because I'm probably wrong. In The Martian, he feels a little more like a science superhero, whereas Grace feels like a clever guy who is a scientist figuring out problems, but and ends up overcoming. He feels a lot more real and typical.
I think Gosling might be a part of that for me because he tends to play people that are more like realistic and grounded, I think.
Yeah.
Because Matt Damon is Jason Bourne.
So. He's Jason Bourne. He also played in Good Will Hunting, which is his character there is extraordinarily, you know, intellectually gifted. And he plays these sorts of characters that are very quick and quite sharp.
That's true.
And so I guess his natural approach to certain types of characters probably came through for both of them. I feel like Ryan Gosling then in so many ways feels like a really good casting choice.
Yeah.
And he played the character really well because you can write the screenplay, but as I was watching something else for another writer talking about writing his own screenplay, it's just like, you can write that, but it's up to the director and the actors. They're the ones that bring it to life and you're kind of at their mercy and hope for how they decide to do that and the quality they bring to it.
Like that they interpret it in the way you're trying to present, right?
That, or even you write it and you're like, I'm not even sure how this should look. And so I'm kind of just hoping they figure it out.
Okay.
Right. Gotcha. Because, you know, a lot of these writers, they're like, well, I write books. I don't write films. Right. Andy Weir was talking about this. He's like, you know, when they visualize this stuff, he's like, I had no visualization. He's like, all these things were just kind of vague blobs in my brain. So when it was Ryan Gosling, when they made Rocky the way they made it, he's like, yeah. It's kind of like he retconned that in his own mind. It's like, yep, that's what Rocky looks like. Because he didn't have that in his mind. And so the creative folks and the director and whoever else figuring that out was really a big part of bringing that to life in a way that he, as the original writer, didn't really have in mind.
Yeah, yeah. And I think probably only in the last few years they would have been able to like present something like Rocky on screen as well.
Well, Rocky... And we were going to talk about this anyway, so it's great, great that you're bringing it up. Rocky is mostly like real.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. There's That's a cool. puppeteer, if I recall.
Okay.
Okay. And originally, you know, the voice you hear when the translation's coming by the computer.
Yeah.
I believe that's the puppeteer's voice, and originally. He was, because it was just Ryan Gosling, like, acting and, like, alone. And so this guy was saying something so he wasn't alone. So he would say these things. And eventually, like, actually, let's make that the translation voice for Rocky. But that was not the original plan. That's my understanding. It was just because they were doing this thing so that Ryan Gosling wasn't, like, totally isolated on set.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'd say most of it is just, like, real physical effects.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I think that's a great thing. I've been seeing it more and more. Like, I think of Dune, right? They obviously they use CGI, but they use a lot of physical stuff. I think of Frankenstein, right, as another example. Because we've been sort of CGI'd to death in many respects, whether it's Marvel, Star Wars, all these different things. It's nice to see physical effects because you get this more textured, real-looking scene or character on the screen. We talked a little bit about Rocky already, but I want to talk about him sort of as an idea, right? As an alien, and also the relationship between him and Grace throughout the film. Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you, just because you like one thing on Instagram, I'm now being fed a bajillion videos, and it's a big deal. People are loving the Rocky as a character. It's not quite to the level of Baby Yoda.
I was just going to say,
but it's like it's close enough that the comparison can be made because it is a very lovable character.
Yeah,
and despite essentially being a rock, it's cute. Wait. Yeah. What did you think of Rocky?
No, I agree. I mean, I kept thinking of Pixar when I was watching the film.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, you know, Rocky's like the new Pixar character, other than like one or two jump scares that they did. But it was just very cute. Like, they gave it like a nice voice that was like very enticing for people. Mm-hmm. And then I think the way it moves was like kind of whimsical. So mm-hmm.
It kind of feels a little bit like Ryan Gosling's character, Grace, kind of nerdy.
Yeah.
Like, how do you like listen to a rock and be like, you're kind of nerdy, but it is that, but in a cute, endearing way, because Rocky's very curious, very thoughtful. I think, again, this is a big thing. We'll talk about the film overall. Very positive, right? Season of the life form, and I mean, he's like, oh, great! Finally, I'm not alone. Maybe someone to work with, like all that sort of stuff. Very clever, and you learn a little bit about, we'll call it, his background, right? Mm-hmm. Gender's a little unclear on this sort of stuff, but yeah. we'll say that. I just thought, and I remember thinking this when I read the novel, that the concept was so creative and unique. Because typically, and I don't know if you're like a Star Trek fan, for example.
I've seen some Next Generation,
but that okay. was a while back. Well, so most of the aliens are, quote unquote, what they call humanoid. Which is like, and part of that is just because budget.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with the concept.
Though, okay. Yeah. And you usually have like two legs, two arms-ish, right? It's basically a similar structure, and then you change some of the details, and voila, alien.
You give them a hat or something.
Sometimes it's just about that bad. I was listening to, and because I've watched a bajillion videos about this film by now, Andy Weir was talking about this, and he was like, at the time of his writing, he was like, okay, we'd found this exoplanet. I forget what it was called. I want to say it was Kepler something or other. And it's like, you know, 8 times the mass of Earth. It's very, very close to its star. It's spinning a lot thick. You know, he made a bunch of assumptions based off of this, which are more or less scientifically grounded. And he's like, what kind of being might develop out of this kind of environment, right? What would they not need? What would they need? What might that be like? And so he developed on that basis. One of the big things, having read the book, I was wondering how they were going to adapt the way Rocky communicates. Because it's basically like communication through music notes.
Hmm.
Where I was like, I don't know how you visualize that.
Did they not have the computer translation?
They did, but you're reading a book, right? So
Yeah.
No. You see it, so you don't feel that gap. But visually, right, in a visual medium, I was like, I have no idea how they're going to do it. But they did it really well. I didn't feel an issue at all, right? They started the translation and you very quickly, so you were just hearing the computer do its thing.
Right.
And I was like, wow, this is remarkably smooth. Like, nothing feels unnatural here. It's all working. So I just thought it was a remarkably creative and yet also scientifically grounded approach to creating a fictional alien, that it wasn't just, you know, the classic humanoid, whatever, or like, you know, green spaceman. I just really appreciate that creativity.
Yeah.
You feel like, despite being aliens, despite like in basically every way being different other than being a sentient life form, they not only work together, but they become buddies.
Yeah.
Like really good friends.
Yeah.
They're sharing a lot of like, you know, personal information and really becoming very like close, intimate friends. And this is very sweet. And I think it's a different flavor of the same sort of feeling that Gene Roddenberry, when he created Star Trek, had. Where you, obviously, you do have some hostile aliens out there, right, in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But broadly speaking, you're going out there to make friends, right? And the assumption is that other beings, well, broadly speaking, also be interested in that. And so seeing that on screen and not, you know, being like, well, literally like the film's Alien, where they are not friendly. Right?
Yeah.
And just a bunch of other sci-fi films that involve aliens, most of the time those aliens are hostile, right? And they're trying to exterminate us or something.
Yeah.
Or exactly. Or we're trying to exterminate them. It's almost never on friendly terms. And so the fact that first contact, while a little awkward, is fundamentally good, and everyone kind of gives everyone benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. right? And they are able to overcome that and like build a bond and realize, you know, yeah, we're real different, but also we're kind of the same and we're all on this journey together. And I just think that's really sweet.
And maybe to tie it to what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. Like Rocky does also almost sacrifices himself to save Grace.
He actually cares. And in turn, later on, Grace kind of does the same thing, right? Because mm-hmm. he could have just gone back to Earth. He was fine. But when he realized that more than likely Rocky was dead in the water because of what happened with the astrophage, he went back. Yeah. And so doing not only saved his friend, but, you know, his friend's entire planet. Because he is not only a reluctant hero at the start, he actively runs away from it.
Right.
But in this moment, he's kind of, and no one can make him this time. Last time, he had no choice.
That's a good point, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They gave him a tranquilizer and shipped him off.
Yeah, Volan told him to go.
Yeah, exactly. Very much. Volan told and then some. People are like, oh, too close to home. But here, he could just keep trucking, right? No one but himself to kind of morally berate him or anything like that. And yet he makes a decision to kind of sacrifice himself willingly. And he figures out how to get stuff back to Earth, and so everyone wins. And I appreciate that Andy Weir did that. But for Grace himself, it's a personal sacrifice he did not need to make. But given kind of a similar scenario, him and being able to potentially live the rest of his life on Earth versus saving a whole people, he chooses the latter. And I think that shows, one could say growth, but certainly a change in thinking for Grace. And I think that is a big part of his character arc. So we touched on it earlier, mm-hmm. but this film differs from a lot of sci-fi, and we also kind of alluded to this by comparing it favorably to Star Trek, is it really has a positive and optimistic story and vision for sort of humanity and how we're going to interact with the universe, you know, beyond us, whether we encounter other sentient beings or you know, what have you. And I think that's in stark contrast to a lot of sci-fi that tend to be, you know, apocalyptic or dystopian, mm-hmm. kind of a future based off of the worst impulses, right?
Yeah, like Blade Runner is a good example.
Blade Runner, yeah. it is a dire future.
Yeah.
But there's so many. There's just so many.
Right.
Where that's the case. I think a positive, optimistic vision and kind of giving people the benefit of the doubt that they can sort of rise above the worst impulses, I think is a rare treat. And it's not that we need to just, everything needs to be positive and we can't have negative things, because sci-fi often is trying to sort of create a scenario to make a point, right? But I think also Andy Weir has made a point here as well. It's like, it doesn't seem to be that way. We have the choice, right? We can choose mm-hmm. how we want to work together, how we want to connect with the rest of the universe that we live in, and how we want to build our future. And I just really appreciate a different approach.
Yeah, I agree. I think this film really like veers from a lot of what we see, like mm-hmm. you know, you're saying. So I think this kind of like the contrast again with you know, cyberpunk, where it's kind of like dystopian Los Angeles in Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this one starts with a classroom and it feels very hopeful.
Yeah. And even, you know, the students, they're excited to learn about this sort of stuff. It's mm-hmm. not like he's struggling to get through to them. I mean, there are good stories around that sort of thing, but it yeah. can start to feel like a trope.
Yeah.
And I do feel, I don't know if it's necessarily sci-fi writing in terms of literature, but I feel in film, it's lazy. I feel like, look, films like this have sold before, so mm-hmm. we're going to take that, and we're going to repackage it, and we're going to push it out, and we're going to make money again.
Okay. I think it is film, but the cyberpunk like books too tend to be very dystopian. Like, I'm trying to remember the name, Neuromancer.
That's like the original cyberpunk.
Yeah. Like that's very
from the '80s, right? But you know, and for those who aren't sci-fi nerds, like cyberpunk is a subgenre of sci-fi, right?
True.
But when I see it on film, it feels like it's like 50% of what's out there.
That's true.
Maybe not, but it's like it's if it accounts for like 5% of sci-fi, and I'm just making up numbers, it's like 25% or more of the sort of films that we see.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, it's either cyberpunk or cyberpunk adjacent, like inspired. For me, again, I've always been attracted to Star Trek. Star Wars is a great space opera, but it's not a positive vision of the future.
Yeah.
And it's not trying to be. It's telling a classic tale in space, right? Where Star Trek has an actual like sort of moral and ethical sort of vision and all that sort
of
stuff.
Much cleaner, too.
It is. Well, you know, when they've got their sort of utopian future, which is its own kind of daydream, but I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Right, because it's a breath of fresh air, and I just enjoy the fact that someone came in saying, it's like, you know what, but what if we chose to build a positive and hopeful future? You know? I mean, because even, and this is, I guess, getting in more into like some contemporary stuff, but even when we think about some of the challenges we face at a global scale, it's like, yeah, we see some of the worst impulses coming up, but we also see some of the best. And it's not to say we should ignore what's not good out there, but saying how can we take what is good or what we want things to be and make it so? And even though I don't know if this film is entirely saying all of that, I feel like it touches on that sensibility and that way of thinking. And I just really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
We've run through, I think, the greatest hits in this film, things we love, things we thought were interesting. Overall, what did you think of the film? What did you think was good? What did you think was perhaps even bad? Something in between, strange, interesting?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought it brought out some of the best elements of some of the earlier Pixar films in terms of like the positivity and the exploration of...
Wait, is this a Pixar film?
No.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
Just saying, like, did I miss something?
It felt like... Oh, it has like the Pixar vibe.
Okay,
I just want to make sure. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. Am I expecting Wall-E to come into this?
Yeah. I thought about Wall-E during a lot of the movie. That's why I kept thinking, oh, Pixar.
It does have that vibe, right? Yeah. It is cute. It is sweet. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Fair point.
But, you know, like, I feel like... there's just some quality, and I think you actually did a great job of describing it just now, of like what that quality is. And this film brings it out, and I feel like people connect to it, and that's why it's doing so well. So actually, like one thing I forgot to mention earlier is that the film holds every weekend has been like only dropping like 30-something%, which is like fantastic for movies.
Yeah. Right, you expect more like half or something.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So yeah, I think people are resonating with that, and I think it's great.
You know, it's a different story. It's not another Marvel thing. It's not another dystopian sci-fi that people go to see because it's flashy. It's unique, and I think it's gotten a lot of positive press coming out of it. So as I think the person of the two of us who did read the book, right? It's a really good adaptation. Because oftentimes I see a lot more compromise with an adaptation. They did cut out some stuff. And to be honest, I have no qualms with that. It's like, oh, yeah, that's not critical to the story. Andy Weir talked about this as well. It's like, oh, I would have loved to have this scene or that scene. But like, you've only got so much film to run and it was not core to the story. And so he's like, yeah, I had to go. And he's like, I totally get that. And I felt the same way. There were some things like, oh, this was sort of cute. Oh, they talked about this more, but it's like, I don't feel like I was missing out. In some ways it was a tighter story because it was forced into a certain time frame, and it still wasn't short. It was a little over 2 hours. But I did not feel like, it did not feel like it dragged.
I agree. I think it was very well paced.
Good pacing. It kept me engaged. And this is me knowing how it ends before it even starts rolling. Right? And I was still like, what's next? Except I know what's next because I read the book. But even so, I was always so curious to see how they were going to adapt it, particularly when we were meeting Rocket, because I hadn't seen any releases. I did not know. So I was like, this is the big challenge in my mind of how are they going to adapt that to a visual medium?
Yeah.
I was like, wow, you did really good. It was just a good film. Well adapted, great story, well told. I love the fact that it had like budget and they did the physical effects. Because even the stuff where Grace is having to do the spin, right? They have him on wires and all that sort of stuff. And they also, when they're, I think, collecting astrophage and you've got like all those red lights, apparently that's a trick they can do when they removed like the filter on the camera or something like that and ran light in a certain way.
Oh, cool.
It's a real thing that
we
wouldn't see, but the camera picks up in a certain way and then translates into like wavelengths and what have you. That I don't remember all the details. It was like, that is so cool and so random.
Yeah.
But it looked amazing. And I was just like, this is, film can be awe-inspiring and you don't need to do everything in a computer. Right, there are creative stuff that maybe looks a bit silly when you're doing it, but on film looks brilliant and really aids in the storytelling. Like, it was very immersive. I was totally pulled in. It felt like a real places, real story. I guess at the end with the we'll call it the was it Eridanians, I think is the race's name, the children,
and he's
teaching the class.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I'm not really buying this, but it's cute, so you get a pass. It was cute. I was just like, no points are lost here. It's just a really nice film. I'm actually thinking about seeing it once more, and I almost never do that. The last time I did this was Dune, because Dune, I was like, this is a story that is built for theater, for the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to watch that on a laptop. Like, it's fine, but you lose so much.
Right.
The scale, the gravity, right? The depth of the world and the power and all that sort of stuff really needs the fully immersive sound and vision. I felt like this also did quite well, sort of being on the big screen. And so I might go back and see it once more before it exits theaters. If I were to give it a score, because I like doing that, this is an 8.5 out of 10 for me.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. Nice. Which is for those who don't know, that's a very high score for me.
Yeah, it's a great score. Definitely liked it a lot. I feel like I'm trying to think of the most recent movies. I probably would have put Dune 2 on 8.5 or 9. I didn't like it as much as that. So a little bit lower, probably like an 8 for me.
Still a good score.
Yeah.
For me, anything over a 7 is a good score.
Yeah, I think over a 7 is like, I would watch this.
Yeah. It's like, I enjoyed this. I'm glad I went to see it. Anything starting at 5 and below, I'm like, well, it happened. it's a thing that existed and I went and saw it and I will forever have this in my memory, taking up gray space. all right, so last words for anyone who hasn't seen the film, definitely recommend going out to see it, particularly if you enjoy sci-fi. You enjoy sci-fi that's based off of very good science. Andy Weir, for those who don't know, I think was an engineer by trade before he went full-time author. And with the exception of a few things about the astrophage specifically, it's all based on the best science, in physics and engineering that he could find. So it's very well grounded in that way. So it's not a lot of hand waving for the most part. And so it's like a really good, positive story. Definitely recommend it if you haven't seen it. Go ahead and check it out and then maybe come back and watch it again and see how you feel about our take.